In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. Breaking the Currency Code is the title of a video series produced by past guest Harry Hubbard. In previous interviews, we discussed the real meaning of Thanksgiving, the ancient Egyptian repository in the Southern Illinois caves, and also the 2015 interview on ancient maps clearly showing Atlantis and the Bargos Islands at the North Pole, known to be an entrance inside the planet. Remember in 2011, Jordan Maxwell pointed out the old analogy of the banks adjusting the flow of the currency. The banks of the river affect the flow of the current. Our guest, Harry Hubbard, is a researcher and collector of rare books, maps, artifacts, and currency. We talk about a range of collectible paper currency, their origins, ultraviolet aesthetics, watermarks, and various embedded security coding. Another interesting trend that emerges is selective scarcity implemented to drive up the prices of collectible currency. As revealed by Harry Hubbard, the clues in this analysis lead us down a rabbit trail. He's identified the names of printing companies throughout the centuries, merging with one another, lurking on the sidelines, quietly investing in wars, total surveillance, and now an AI-driven cashless society. Harry, welcome back to Another News.
Hey, my pleasure.
Well, it's good to have you back on the show. It's been a while, and you've alerted me to a fascinating series you've put together titled Breaking the Currency Code. You begin taking a look at your collection of early U.S. currency, such as Confederate money from various states, and you single out the Vermont Bank of Windsor. You purchased this on eBay a while back, then suddenly it wasn't such a rare find. Would you tell listeners about this banknote, please?
Well, it's kind of funny. Actually, my colleague Paul purchased it. Well, we were just laughing and giggling, having a fun time on the phone late one evening, and I just happened to—I can't remember if it was New Hampshire or New England. I said, "There's got to be some obscure New England bank that printed currencies in 1820," and so he was typing in, and sure enough, there he found this one loan bank note, a dollar note, Windsor Bank of Vermont. Or was it Vermont Bank of Windsor, one or the other? And I laughed, and we laughed. So he bought it, and he sent it to me so that I could examine it. And at that time, there were none online, and now there's just dozens and dozens of them on. They're all uncirculated, mint condition, paper guarantee, 65, 66. The thing about it is they're all in perfect condition. Nobody's ever heard of this bank. There's no history. There's no documentation. There's nothing about it. And it is the thinnest banknote I have ever seen in the three decades that I've been collecting currencies.
For listeners who may not know about the significance of the thickness of currency, that's going to come up again and again in this interview. Would you let them know why that's important, please?
The thicker the currency, the more difficult it is to counterfeit. And most currencies are like 2.5 thousandths to 3.5 thousandths of an inch thick. American money, your typical dollar bill, with a dollar, 100, 20, 10, 50, whatever, they're all at 4 thousandths of an inch thick, which is pretty thick. I mean, that's why they last long. You crinkle them in your hand, they make that sound. And certain companies put different identifiers or security identifiers in their banknotes, such as fluorescent lengths, tiny little circular donuts, and they embed also different printings within the picture that unless you're looking for them, you're not going to find them. And that it all has to do with certain companies and the way they manufacture their own banknote paper. And that banknote paper may be sent to another country or group or printing press to be stamped out as currency. So it's just a way of being able to identify who actually made a particular currency, what printing company made that currency, even though their name is not printed on the bill itself, such as like Thomas DeLarue or G&D, American Banknote Company, Bundesdruckerei, different companies. It's just something that I've always kind of kept up with, but I'm sure nobody else has ever checked the thickness of their currencies. I'm probably the only currency collector that ever was that measured the thickness.
I know you make some bold claims in Severity of the Scarcity, in that you may be the only one who had looked at the various grades of gold coins and the disparities with the values and how it changed over the last 50 years. An interesting claim to make, but getting back to this particular banknote here, it's an unknown bank in Vermont that really no one's heard of. No one meaning collectors. They're not familiar with that. Why do you think that is?
It does not appear that these Windsor bank notes from Vermont existed 30 years ago. Because, see, I used to, when I was collecting 30 years ago, I would get these catalogs in, and I would look through them, and I had a collection of Federal Reserve notes from the early 1900s. I had greenbacks, Civil War greenbacks from the 1800s on up. I had gold certificates and such like that, and just kind of always kept up with it. And that was something that my father had asked. He said, "Where'd you get these gold certificates?" I said, "Well, I ordered them out of this catalog over here." And he said, "I think we actually went to a numismatic show together, and they had gold certificates there for sale. And the typical uncirculated $10 gold certificate was about $100 back then. I think it's probably doubled in price now. But the issue was," he goes, "man, I never saw these." He goes, "How come they're in pristine mint condition?" He said, "These were all supposed to be turning." He said, "I never saw these when, back in the 60s and 50s when I was collecting, you know, and looking at stuff." And he had some questions in his mind, and I didn't think much about it, you know, like, how come these bills aren't tattered up? But he kind of already suspected. My father suspected a lot of things concerning coins, currencies, books, and folklore and things of that nature.
Well, in the first video of the series that you produced, Breaking the Currency Code, you go through a number of pieces of interesting currency, including baby bonds, Department of Agriculture food coupons, and Joe Camel cash. Is there anything you want to talk about there?
Well, years ago, I thought that nobody would be collecting food stamps. I did. I wanted books that were pristine, and I just held on to them through the ages, through the years. Come to find out, other people did too. Collectors did feel that those would be worth something down the road, or just a piece of nostalgia. And what always fascinated me about the Joe Camel cash is that it was real big, and they were going to shut it down, I think, in 1999. And then somebody pushed a lawsuit on them, and then Joe Camel, he just got zapped, because he was on billboards, he was in magazines, he was a smooth character. He had this big-headed camel face dressed up like George Washington or different caricatures. And when you bought Camel cigarettes in the carton or in the pack, you would get these Camel bonus coupons, basically. And they called it Camel cash. And I always held on to mine because I thought they were pretty. I never smoked Camels or anything, but just thought that they looked neat and held on to them for decades. It's just funny, some of the things that they put on these Camel cash notes. Like you pointed out yourself, you notice they have the all-seeing eye of Joe on them. It's a camel eye in the triangle on top of the pyramid, you know.
Yeah, we were talking about that back in the 90s when this was everywhere. The campaign was in full force. I would say the knowledge of that type of symbolism, Freemason symbolism, whatever you want to call it, that's connected to ancient Egyptian symbolism, the all-seeing eye in the triangle, in the pyramids, the camel and the pyramids.
They were saying also that it was targeting young teens, teenagers and such. But when they in 97, when Joe Camel became illegal, then he was just zapped out of everything. They quit the cash. They quit the coupons. They had to just basically dissolve the whole promotional campaign all at once.
There was also alleging that there was subliminal genitalia in the imagery.
They've always kind of done that with Joe Camel. Back in the 60s and 70s, there was a Camel slogan that you could hold it a certain way and you could see a naked woman in it. Had a naked woman in it. So, yeah, they, I guess, subliminally did have sexual-type content, and they got busted. But unless, you know, if they'd never said anything, it was just something as a joke. But, yeah, that's true. That's true. There's always been, like, naked women and such. And some of Joe Camel's headshots with his nose appeared very, very similar to male genitalia also.
That was in the lawsuit, if I recall.
Yeah, well, okay, well, yeah, possibly. God, that was not very subtle. It was pretty blatant, yeah.
Really a successful marketing campaign for that brand, that's for sure.
Yeah, it sure was.
In book two of Breaking the Currency Code, you look at Russian money and the thickness of those notes. What did you find with the Russian rubles?
Well, several things. The stuff was beautiful, and it was worthless. And by the way, when we're talking book one, book two, these are video designated as videos, but I did this series as books because sometimes that's how I do things to keep track of what my subject matter is more efficiently. The Russian money was just beautiful, and it had UV signatures, and I had Russian money from the 60s, 70s, 80s, et cetera, and the 90s. And I just liked it, and it had these fancy watermarks, and it got me to want, you know, and then as I collected more currencies, it was obvious to me that the same people were printing up everyone's currencies, that there were just a handful of money manufacturers, if you will. And that's what I pursued to want to know more about, is the manufacturers, because the people who were manufacturing individual countries' currencies had control more so of that currency than the central banks, world banks, et cetera, et cetera. To me, the source is the key. And that's what I pursued, is like, well, who's stamping out this money? So I just figured that the American Banknote Company was stamping out American money, but then I also discovered that they were stamping out other countries' money, including Russia.
There's an interesting dynamic that occurs with the printing of currency during periods of war. You have Allied military currency, the Japanese invasion money. Would you talk about the currency of the Bosnia, Croatia, Slovenia, Yugoslavia war?
Well, back in the early 90s, the powers that be were trying to, after they tried to integrate Yugoslavia, they started pushing all these foreigners and Muslims into Yugoslavia, so you have a hotbed. You got Catholics, Orthodox, and you're pushing Muslims. It just became a war zone. And there were five, they broke Yugoslavia up into five nations, and each one of these all of a sudden had their currency at the same time, and they were all overlapping each other. So whatever currency you had in your pocket, I wonder how they did the exchange rate on that. So in the same area, you know, a place that's not too big on the map, had all these different currencies, and boom, they all had them at once. Well, what was the connection there? How did all of these tiny breakaway renegade countries get their currencies printed up so quickly? It's like, for instance, today, when there's a protest. Let's say that somebody calls for a protest in Portland, Oregon, on a certain issue with Antifa or whatever. Well, how is it that they all have hundreds and hundreds of signs printed up exactly the same that are brand new with that topic that just came out of the printer's office? Boom, everybody's got one all of a sudden. Where'd they get it? Who's doing that? So the same principle applies today with protest signs. How come they always, like in Washington, D.C., Chicago, Seattle, L.A., San Francisco, all these cities that have a lot of protests, how do these people who are protesting get their signs? And I'm sure they're not paying for them. Somebody's got to pay for them. Somebody's got to print them up. They got to be coming from somewhere, and the same principle applies.
I can see the analogy.
And then when you've got a war-torn nation with five different active currencies all at once, who's paying for the currency? Who's paying to have it printed up, and what is it going to be backed by?
Well, that's an interesting question, because you were alluding how a currency, fiat money, isn't backed by gold, but you did say that, and it was an interesting comment because I hadn't thought of it this way, the U.S. currency is really, it's backed by the military.
Yes, and that's what you have to realize. People say, oh, our money's worthless, it's fiat money. We need to return to the gold standard. Well, first of all, whenever you hear anybody say that, that means that they don't know anything about gold, okay? They don't know anything about gold. That's not the way to go. And they don't realize that it's the government, and whoever says this is worth this, that's what goes. And it becomes your government, your tanks, your planes, your fighter jets, your bombs, your cruise missiles, your standing army, or your drone capabilities. And that is what is protecting the value of your money. And the protection of that money is just understood. And there's a lot of money, for instance, that is stamped out, printed up, that never gets into circulation. For instance, when those Marines, when they raided Saddam Hussein's palace, one of his palaces, they found $600 million behind a wall. Well, that was pulled out of the news very quickly. That's when, and I did a little stint on that in my No News is Good News. It's because one of the reporters said they were uncirculated. Well, that was the key. Evidently, Saddam knew the guy that flew the plane. He knew who printed it, how it got there, everything. It was all a setup. That was a direct tie to our government money establishment, Bureau of Engraving and Printing in Philadelphia, that just sewed it up. Well, as soon as that reporter said that, boom, they yanked that story right out of the news. Because anybody that collects currencies that knows about uncirculated bills, 600 million in $100 bills, uncirculated, duh, it doesn't take a genius to figure that one out.
It was deliberately shipped from the mint, and I assume...
Or the White House. It was definitely a government scam.
Speaking of Saddam Hussein, you point out in the second video, the banknotes, Saddam Hussein banknotes, are 2.5 thousandths of an inch thick, and the Iraq notes are 3 thousandths of an inch thick. What's the significance of that?
That means that two different companies were supplying him with money. Aren't his bills, banknotes, beautiful? Those Saddam Hussein notes are beautiful.
Especially under ultraviolet. But yeah,
yes.
Quite something. You ask, who printed Saddam Hussein's currency before he was public enemy number one?
Right. Or while he was public enemy number one. Even after he was public enemy number one, he was still getting his currency stamped out. Looks to me like it was from Philadelphia. But I'm sure there were other companies, too, that were giving him money or stamping out his money for his central bank. And that's the whole thing, is this series ties in the World Bank with all the central banks, and it goes beyond the conspiracy theorist slogans and what the conspiracy people do. I show it to you. I don't make it up or guess, and if there's people who have questions concerning the World Bank and central banks, the reason I kind of wanted to do all this was with the how human trafficking has just blossomed since fall of 2016 and into the news. It's really, really become an issue than it ever has before. And I tie all that together in a very strange way. The information is there, but you have to find it. You have to want to find it, and you're not going to find it in books or this or that. Like with this particular series, I don't think I used any books at all. I just used the currencies and the bills and coins and whatever. And I used some things that I found online concerning some of the companies that are stamping out the money.
Yes, we'll definitely get into that in a minute. In the second video, you look also at Antarctica money and ask, where's the Bank of Antarctica? These banknotes are 3.5 thousandths of an inch thick.
Classy money. And they're beautiful. They're beautiful. You can buy them online, actually. They are quite fancy. Not much in the UV department, but now we have plastic bills with clear windows and different things like that, polymers. But the American money is by far the ugliest of all. But it is durable, and, you know, it holds its own, but it's just not pretty to look at. There's not much there to collect when it comes to American money, as far as I'm concerned. Now, the old American money, the old big bills and the colored stuff, gold certificates, you know, but after they're all just the same size and green color, yeah, they did that just to kind of simplify the streamline the process of stamping out the currencies. How much more money does it take to print a $100 bill than it does a $20 bill? Well, maybe a couple of cents, penny or two. But if you go like with a $1 bill and a $20 bill, it's the same paper, same ink, just different words, basically, you know.
Harry, would you talk about why embattled, such as Venezuela, don't issue coins in their currency?
Well, Venezuela had coins up to about 9 or 10 years ago. And the coins were worth more as scrap metal than they were for whatever they were minted as. So that's what happened. All of their coinage just went into manufacturing or what, it just got recycled. And so Venezuela hasn't had any coins for, I guess, almost a decade. And another country, strangely enough, that is oil rich, that doesn't have coins, is Iran. As far as I know, there's no coinage in Iran. Now, I could be wrong, but I can't see any online. There's none available. And I, with my research, if somebody can see that that there is coins, currency from Iran. Now, I'm talking about from modern day, not from the 60s, the 70s, et cetera. I'm talking about for right now. And it's just odd that Venezuela is sitting on, what, trillions of barrels of oil, and their currency is worthless, and they got all that oil in the ground. Well, who determined that Venezuela's money is worthless? Well, somebody in the American government, for instance, calls up whoever's printing up Venezuelan money and says, hey, stop printing Venezuelan money. And then the money becomes scarce in no time because money wears out. Some of it gets burned up. Some of it gets lost. Some of it dissolves in the washing machine or whatever. And so that currency becomes more valuable or less valuable. Hey, this, it's worthless, but, you know, it's because they're not getting any more. People are hoarding it, thinking that it's going to go back up in value. And so it just becomes a circle of events that just spiral down into a rabbit hole.
Speaking of scarcity, another video series you had produced is titled Severity of the Scarcity, and I believe there are five videos on that one, and you suggested for me to watch the fifth one, and I did. And in a Coin World magazine article, it pointed out that China has former U.S. mint production equipment for manufacturing high-quality U.S. coin fakes.
Yes.
That's really fascinating because, first of all, how did they get it? Mm-hmm. There was some collusion going on, most likely.
Yeah.
I was wondering if there is a deliberate act of counterfeiting to increase the value of American coins.
If no one can tell the difference, how does that happen? Okay. So basically, give a little brief summary of Severity of the Scarcity is my take. I show my audience the history of gold coinage in the United States. And I bring it up through the 1800s into the last century and up to present day. I quit at June of 2018. That was the last magazine date that I show in that series. And it is very good for anyone who thinks they want to collect gold or silver, or that that gold, owning gold, is a hedge against inflation. And that's just a marketer's choice of words. I mean, I don't agree with everything Mark Cuban says, but when it comes to money, the boy's pretty sharp on his toes. And there's a video online where he says, someone asked him, what do you think about owning gold? He said, I would rather own pet rocks. He said, instead of buying gold, buy pet rocks. He makes a lot of sense. He covers, you know, why. And It makes good sense. Gold, people think it's a hedge against inflation, but they can never use it for currency. You can never buy anything with it, and it's just a false sense of security. And when you buy gold, you pay a lot more for it than what it's worth, and when you sell it, you have to sell it for a lot less than it's worth. So how is that a good investment? You know, how's that a good investment, Jeff? And same thing with silver, but on a lower, you know, in scale. Now, what the Chinese did was they just pretty much flooded the market with these rare gold coins. And that's kind of what I show coming up through in the books, that all of a sudden there's more and more and more of these rare coins from the 1800s and early 1900s. You have so many more now than you had when they were issued and available. They know how many were issued. I wouldn't be surprised if 200 years from now we actually have more of the actual coins than were initially minted. Wouldn't be surprised at all. Chinese having these proof dyes and everything, I show you right there. They got hundreds and hundreds, thousands of them. That's just one mint. And the expert numismatists over here or coin collectors and dealers, they're wondering, like, how is China making such good coins? Look at it right there. It is in the magazine. They have American equipment specialized for the purpose.
What's disturbing here, Harry, is the numismatist's official literature doesn't seem to have a problem with this necessarily, because they've adopted the influx of more uncirculated gold coinage. And you were asking, how are we all of a sudden getting uncirculated gold coinage from the 1800s?
Yes. How come we have uncirculated and uncirculated proofs from the 1800s when none of the catalogs from the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s had them in there? And, they were all supposed to be turned in, right? And the United States government was supposed to be melting down all of these beat-up gold coins. Well, how come we have so many of them today from the 1800s and early 1900s? See, we used to have gold coins, the eagles, quarter eagles, half eagles, double eagles, et cetera. And if we had them then and they were all supposed to be turned in, so, well, if it's a commemorative coin or if it's a collectible coin, you can keep it. But we have so many that you could barely tell that they're a gold coin, and they're selling them. I mean, thousands and thousands of them. And this is what I put together back in the early 90s, is that when gold became illegal to own in 1933, all these good, fine people took their gold to the banks. Banks turned the gold into the reserve banks. It all went to Washington, and then they just sat on it for 50 years, and then they started selling those coins back to the public at a much more inflated rate. I don't think they melted down any of them. I don't think they melted. I think they actually made. Because, see, what they can do is they could take a gold, let's say a double eagle from late 1800s, 1880 or so, and they can heat that sucker up, and then, boom, restamp it with a different date on it. In other words, they use the same flan or the same slug and make it a proof. They can make it a proof if they want to, because they still have those dyes. They still have plenty of dyes, and they can make more dyes. There is no control. And I prove in that series how the U.S. Mint changed and doctored dates. They admitted it. Again and again and again. Well, see, then I'm putting it all together. Well, if they're bragging about changing these dates, and then why can't they change these dates? Why can't they put this coin and just restamp or restrike this coin and make it something else?
Have numismatists responded to this particular issue?
No. They are only concerned about selling coins and making money, covering their mortgages and car payments and insurance, et cetera, supporting their families by selling gold, silver, and coins. That's the only thing that they don't really, I don't think they care anything about authenticity, and I think that many of them would sell you a fake just as soon as look at you. Well, look at all the people that buy silver and gold online. You can't do that anymore. You can't do it anymore, because if you do, you just find somebody's slug. You're just getting taken to the cleaners. Because if you're going to buy gold and silver online, you need to have a place where you can sell it. Otherwise, you're going to get stuck with it. Because chances are, it's a whopper. If it's a gold coin, if it's a silver medallion or these little silver bricks from China, you cut them open, they're all plugged.
Oh, interesting. Then would you suggest any type of investment in gold coins or collectible coins?
No, not at all. Not at all. It's a mindset. A simulated mindset, and it can change at any time. When you buy it, you're upside down, unless the price goes way up. Now, when silver back years ago, when silver went up to $48 an ounce, okay, well, then everybody sold a bunch of their silver. A lot of people made out good. And then it went back down to, what, $12 an ounce again or so. Well, it takes a swing like that to make any money. Who is it that wakes up in the morning and sets the price of gold? Okay, you'll see all, if somebody researches that, they're going to see a just a circle of events that, oh, well, this did this, the oil price over here. There's somebody that makes the phone call every morning that says, okay, gold is such and such. It's a single guy or just a single group of people. It's not some, the world market. It's not a country, this country or that country or this country. It's somebody in the capacity of like a George Soros or something like that, you know, that's controlling it all.
Somebody who would benefit greatly by setting the price of gold.
Yeah, and then I show you in that severity of the scarcity how they store gold, just warehouse after warehouse. You have to move it around on pallets made out of railroad ties. Unbelievable. And the price of gold doesn't go up a penny.
How much are those railroad ties, those pallets?
$650 a piece. Did the price of your gold go up? No. So is that a good investment? You just spent $650. Now you got to buy a $2,000 unit just to make sure that the gold coin is for real, because there's so many fakes out there that are plugged.
In book three of your video series, Breaking the Currency Code, this is where the identifiers show up and reveal clues of more printing companies. Why did you want to present this?
Well, for one, I'm fascinated with it. Number two, it kind of shows where certain companies have their own identifiers and where certain countries will pay to have their own identifiers. And in these small, tiny countries like Zambia, Ghana, Gambia, whatever, they got all these currencies, and they change their currencies a lot, and they're beautiful. They're beautiful to the naked eye, and they're beautiful to under, you know, intensity UV. So the question comes up, you know, that I'm trying to get my viewer interested in is how are these small countries paying for their currency? Who is paying for it? Who is paying the printer to print their currencies? And I show all these small countries, and there's even more. And I show some of the most obscure countries on the planet that have their own currency. I believe that's at the end of book two, where I show some countries that there ain't nobody lives there, but they have their own currencies.
Right, the Jason Islands?
Yeah, you got all these tiny little places that have, you know, currencies, and like, what for? How are they paying? What's the reason? What's the purpose of it? And I highlight, what, 10 different countries with less than, what, 5,000 people that have all these currencies.
Right. Easter Island.
These tiny countries out in the middle of the Pacific or out in the middle of the Caribbean, how do they obtain their currency? The paper goes to the printer, or the printer manufactures it. They put their identifiers in the paper. They stamp it. They put the inks together. These are sophisticated inks. They are fluorescent. They have different color characteristics when you shine them under UV, or ultraviolet, or black light, either one. And so how are these small countries obtaining their currency? Are they flying them over in a Cessna? Are they coming over in a speedboat? Are they bailed up in plastic bags and flown over? Are they flown in commercial airlines? Oh, yeah, by the way, we've got 21 passengers and $40 billion worth of Asian currency, you know, in the back. I mean, do they fly them on FedExpress jets? You know, how do they move around large sums of currency? Because I show in one video where they're just stamping out bales of money. I mean, it's coming off the conveyor belt. Just big bales, about half the size of a hay bale, that's nothing but paper currencies all bound up.
Yeah, it really is interesting. So you examine the Afghan notes, the various identifiers encoded into bills, U.S. Treasury checks, the watermarks within those, and then early American Express cards and a MasterCard, there are marks, identifiers that show up under ultraviolet light. It really is,
yeah.
Interesting. So in this video, you reference Scotty's Lumber Yard in Florida, Scotty's Money. They issued their own currency. Tell listeners about that, please.
Well, it was like a coupon campaign, you know, kind of like a discounts on stuff like that. A throwback to the old S&H green stamps and gold bond stamps, et cetera, top value. It was just a promotional thing, and I liked the currency. I was going and buying Scotty's stuff, and then you get the coupons, and then when you've got several of them, well, you had $10 in Scotty's money. Well, then you could go get a shovel and some gloves or this or that. And I liked the currency because it just felt good. It was made, or actually printed, by the American Banknote Company. And it says it right there on the bill. And I'm like, how in the world did this company get such good quality paper money? This is just a lumber yard. But they were a big lumber yard. They built Florida. And they went under about 10, 12 years ago or so. I don't know. Home Depot and Lowe's came in and kind of pushed them out of the driver's seat. But that Scotty's Money was just fascinated. And it does have UV fiber identifiers in it. So Scotty's coupon paper money had more security identifiers in it, security codes, than the American money ever will have, because they're not going to be able to do that with American money.
Again, they were 0.004 of an inch thick, which
that was the dead giveaway. That whoever was stamping out the Scotty's money was for sure stamping out American money, but it had, you know, it's a no-brainer. I had it right there on it, American Banknote Company.
The Scotty's logo, the face of that logo was in the center of the bill, and it's a typecasted Scottish man with the hat and the beard. But I noticed in the center of the beard is a stylized 666.
Yeah. And there might be more if you look at them. You know, some of these bills, I don't have time to spend hours with each currency, but I'm sure that I would find even more stuff. When you can find some of the camouflage stuff that I have found on some of these bills that I show, well, you can definitely tell I've spent a lot of time with my collections.
In book 4 of your video series, the control and agenda of some of these printing companies such as TDR Manufacturing, GD, Morpho, and others becomes really clear. Can you tell listeners about this?
Well, several of the companies have begun to merge, and whenever they get in trouble, it seems like they'll merge somewhere else or change the name. And like that one company, Oberther, OT Morpho, well, they've been in and out of trouble with the World Bank and central banks for years, decades. So, and I show it right there. I mean, you know, they say, well, they were taken off the stock market listing. Now they got punished for 2.5 years. They can't do business with the World Bank. Well, what were they doing with the World Bank? And they're stamping out these countries, small countries' currencies. Well, how are those small countries paying for their bills? And same thing with Venezuela. How was Venezuela, for instance, paying for their bills? Now, you have Venezuela, and let's throw Saddam Hussein in there too. Their banknote currencies are beautiful. They're beautiful. There's no doubt. That means, and they got watermarks, they got this, they got all these security features embedded. They are expensive to print. Okay, now when you look at a Saddam Hussein note or a Venezuelan note and you hold a dollar bill up next to it, which one do you think is cheaper to manufacture? The American dollar would be. The paper is more expensive, but the ink on it is just dirt cheap. But with Venezuela and the old Saddam Hussein money, the inks and the dyes on them are just a lot more expensive to manufacture. It would be a no-brainer. Flamboyant, beautiful stuff, beautiful currency. I recommend anybody collect currencies that you like, currencies that you think are pretty, and stuff that's not too expensive, like Saddam Hussein notes, Venezuelan notes, Russian money. Russian money is worthless, and it's fun. I mean, there's history. You learn history with these countries. And that's how I picked up on the history of Yugoslavia and its currency, is by going to the coin shows. Because when I started collecting, you couldn't just jump online and go to eBay and order you know, Venezuelan currencies or Saddam Hussein. No, you had to go to the coin shows where they were selling paper currencies, and you had to see what they had.
We're going to hear part of that presentation, Severity of the Scarcity, with Harry Hubbard, our guest.
Indian Head Eagles, 1907, 1908, Denver, $300,000 for this one, and we don't have any proofs for some reason. Motto on reverse. And there was a lot of controversy with the coinage back in the 1800s and early 1900s over should our money have "In God We Trust" on it. And there were a lot of politicians that just firmly did not want that on there for various reasons. You can do your own research on that if you want to. And with the motto on reverse, here's your prices. We're still moving up to the time when gold was banned. Now we're going to jump into the double eagles. No motto on reverse. Picking up in 1849, unique. There are none of them available, but there might be in like 50, 60 years. Or you can call up China. You know, maybe China can stamp you out a few of them. And here we go with the 1854 Nolans. $350,000, and we don't have any MS high ratings or proofs in this. Here's one for $500,000, 1856 Nolans, double eagle, $400,000. If you can just barely tell it's a coin, it'll cost you $200,000. You may have to go and pick it up. I wonder, if you're shipping a coin that's worth $500,000, how do you insure that? I mean, do you take it to an airport? Do you ride with it in a taxi cab? Do you fly it in a Cessna? I'm just asking. How about a speedboat? Here's one here, 1860, $375,000. About finished jumping over here on page 94. Here's one for $375,000. Here's one for $200,000. And in just 2 point grades is $105,000. Here's an 1861, $2.1 million. Here's one for $250,000. $375,000, $375,000, just all over the place. Look at this. All of these, over $300,000. Here's one here, $500,000. Carson City Mint. Here's another $250,000, over $250,000. Check out these prices, $350,000, $300,000. Would you have ever thought that American coins, there's just a little bit of gold in them, would have ever commanded such a price? And why? Why? Why are they still in existence? Why are all these still here? Look how many of them. Thousands and thousands and thousands of them. I'm just getting going here. I got a couple more to show you. This is the next column on the same page. All these are $100,000. Check out these prices. This is 1922 here. Here's 1924 S, $140,000. Here's one for 1926 Denver, $210,000. Got one more here to show you. The double eagles, $2 million. The 1927 D, double eagle, they don't even have them in very fine and extra fine condition. Well, I wonder why not. I wonder why not. $2 million. $2 million. $190,000. You'll see here on the 1933 double eagle, zip across the line there, because they were supposed to be illegal. I'm gonna start wrapping this up by showing you some of the pallets that they haul gold around on, And these pallets are very expensive. This is like a typical one here, which could actually be real. But they're like small railroad ties. They're very stoutly built, and they won't hold that much gold or this much gold, but they're just kind of, these are just illustrations. And you see this stack of gold here with the forklift on it? Well, there's no forklift in the world that could pick up that much gold, I'm sure. It was just way too much.
That was just part of the video titled Severity of the Scarcity with Harry Hubbard, our guest. Well, in book four, you show that Thomas de la Rue manufacturing was printed on some African countries' banknotes, Peru,
yeah.
Banknotes. Jamaica was GD, banknote printing company.
Mm-hmm.
Guyana was Thomas de la Rue. And then another company that you revealed was Casa da Moeda do Brasil. And then another one was Bundesdruckerei. Founded in Berlin, 1879, their website, it shows they printed the Third Reich money, but their website says they actually began in 1763.
How many companies did you rattle off there? Was it four or five?
You pointed out Oberthur Fiduciaire and then Oberthur Technologies.
Okay.
And then they merged with Morpho, creating a biometrics banking system. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Okay. And in the first, I believe it was in number two, book two, mm-hmm. I introduced three or four. I introduced one in book three, which is American Banknote Company, and I think three into, so that's four plus, that's 10 different companies that manufacture currencies for countries all over the world.
Okay, and then there's a lot of merging taking place, and
mm-hmm.
what you've pointed out, and I thought this is really fascinating, is, for example, Oberthur Technologies and Morpho, and by the way, Oberthur was at one point the M company, but OT, Oberthur Technologies, and Morpho merged, and they now create biometrics and biometric banking, fingerprints, eye scans, fingerprint capture products, digital.
And that, the name of that company is IDEMIA. That's the name of the company that they merged and changed the name to. And they just did that like 2 years ago, September of 2017.
All right. So this is a multinational French company called IDEMIA, and they're involved in a lot of biometrics, including, as you point out, vein recognition systems.
That's pretty bizarre, isn't it?
So let's tell listeners that these are vein authentication devices that look at the vascular patterns of an individual's palm, finger, or back of the hand as personal data for a global ID.
Yeah, I also go in on book four, and I explain more on how biometrics work. Eye scans and fingerprint scanners and things of that nature, and kind of leave my viewer up to decide for themselves where it's going, because there's so much there, and that I think people should know. I think people should be more interested in biometrics and what's coming down the road. And I'm just weird like that. But showing someone how these measurements are taken and how they're doing all this, after vein recognition, what's next? You know?
Embedded chips, of course. But I feel that it's really important to examine IDEMIA, because just doing a search online, you'll look for the news stories about IDEMIA. They're everywhere. They're watching everything. They're watching the NYPD, the sporting events, they're in facial recognition systems and stadiums, all
mm-hmm.
of that.
Yes. And I show, what I did was I tied IDEMIA, which is artificial intelligence media, in with Google. They all are sitting at the same table. Okay? OT Morpho, IDEMIA. They're all right there with Google.
And I didn't do enough searching on that in particular. Obviously, listeners know about the privacy breaches and indiscretions Google has made in the past decade. That's such an understatement, but it's unbelievable. But here, these two companies, IDEMIA's YouTube channel has very few views and subscribers, but very, very high production value.
Millions and millions. There's no Hollywood movie ever that comes close to what is on that YouTube channel. Nothing. I mean, the actors, actresses, how many Hollywood movies of today, multi-million, say you got a $1 billion movie, how many of them's got as many actors as you see on that channel? None. And when we look at IDEMIA, and it's spelled just like it sounds, IDEMIA, and it ends IA, if you spell it backwards, it's Artificial Intelligence Media, which could be coming down the road. If they could have kept everybody glued to the regular television, because in another 5 years, television stations as we know them today will not exist. The internet will completely take all that away. But what if all of the news stories that came out, because we already have it, you can already see some of it when all of the news agencies are parroting the exact same phrases again and again and again. They're just copying each other, copying. They all say exactly the same thing at the exact same moment on the and there's a bunch of them on YouTube that you can watch. They're kind of okay, what if artificial intelligence creates the media? I'm just saying, is that where we're headed?
It's something to watch out for, and I do believe we're heading in that direction, Harry. So I think it's really important that you put this series of videos together, and it doesn't seem like it's leading in this direction, but there it goes. You also referenced child trafficking. I didn't quite understand that, what you were saying.
That's how some of these small countries, that's the only natural resource they have. If a country's out in the middle of the Pacific and all they have for natural resources is sand and salt water, well, how are they going to pay for their currencies? Well, you can always manufacture humans. The ultimate value in livestock, because when you get into human trafficking between young children and women, well, there you go. Somebody says, okay, and then there's all kinds of backdoor deals. Okay, I'll stamp you out $100,000 if you let me put up a restaurant right here on this corner, you know, or a hotel, or this or that. However, we can think of it in our minds, the actual reality is far, far more sinister, especially when it comes to human trafficking, torturing, debauchery. The reality is far more sinister than we can even imagine. We don't know how to imagine that. In my wildest imagination, I would not be able to approach that realistically.
Well, to end on a lighter note here, you point out a piece of currency that I don't think many listeners may know about. It's called the Hell banknote.
Yeah, the banknote of hell. That's right. That's right. A lot of people didn't realize there was a bank in hell. But yeah, and it's a pretty note. It's a pretty banknote, isn't it?
It's pretty cool. Yeah, there are a number of them. But yeah, I saw the one that you posted. It's beautiful. What is it?
It's just something to make people feel better about their bad ancestors. I guess so there's a lot of people out there that have ancestors that they loved that were just absolutely terrible people. And you buy these hell banknotes, and then you're supposed to take them home and burn them, and to get your ancestral loved one out of hell. But people are collecting them instead. I haven't seen anybody burn any of these hell banknotes on YouTube yet. I thought it was real cool though when I bring it up to the camera, and the fire comes out of his head.
That was interesting, right? That was under the ultraviolet.
Yeah. The fire comes out from behind his head there. So a lot of these, and that's why, you know, a lot of these currencies that I have that I've been collecting for years, they do tricks on the eye, in certain situations, and that was just one of them. That hell banknote is just really fascinating. When I first had learned of it, I'm like, what in the world? It was pretty cool. I'm not going to be collecting any more hell banknotes, but you can get them. You can buy them. They've been around for about 10, 12 years or so.
Yeah, I did a quick search, and I saw that you can buy them on Amazon, basically.
The hell banknote. And I think that just the cosmetic aesthetic appeal is very strong because it's such a beautiful note. It's got the Chinese devil. I guess it's a Chinese devil or Chinese Satan or something. He's got like a wooden hat that sits on his shoulders with tassels that go across. I don't know if it's, I'm not for sure if that's Tibetan or, I mean, do you have any idea who that, who's Mr. Satan that is?
I don't know. Well, I've read it's often in Chinese grocery stores that you can get these.
So it's probably the Chinese devil.
Well, Harry, speaking of mortality, the early printing companies that you referenced, such as Thomas de la Rue, Casa de Moeda do Brasil, the Third Reich money printer,
Yeah. Those
are, they're 200 or 300 years old. It seems like a great family business for vampires.
It's a good hedge against inflation to have your own money stamping, a money printing company. Yes.
Yeah.
That is a good hedge against inflation. And I give the best hedge against inflation in the world at the end of part five of Severity of the Scarcity. That's the best hedge against inflation ever.
To get a job in the night shift of the printing company, the mint.
Yeah.
Here you have these companies, these families who watch the eras come and go from their perches, you know, and they're watching everything. Well, Harry, you never fail to take listeners on a fascinating journey with your investigative work. And in this case, you did break the currency code. And I thank you for being on In Other News.
Well, I appreciate it. We'll do it again sometime. I have to give credit to my colleague, Paul Shafranca, on that. He's the one that came up with the name. I didn't know what to name the series, to be honest with you. I had no clue. I just was saying, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. And he goes, what you're doing is you're breaking the currency code.
Well, big thank you out there to Paul Shafranca as well.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit InOtherNewsRadio.com for archives and more information about the guests.